My name's Eric Wishart from AFP. I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight. We've got a very interesting mixed audience. This coincides with a hostile environment training course for AFP, so we've got some of our, you know, the kind of wizened guys with the beards at the back are some of our war correspondents, and so it's quite interesting. But I think, don't take this as the wrong way, but I think even more interestingly, we've got quite a few students from the local journalism schools. And I think this is, if you're going to pursue a career in journalism, this is absolutely fundamental to how you cover stories and how you survive this profession. So very pleased that the local universities advertised this foreign correspondence club event and that you took the time to come. So I'd like to introduce the panel tonight. To start from my left, Tim Schwartz, producer from CNN, Phil Smith from Reuters, and Tony Loughlin, who's the security consultant and an ex. You're not ex-SAS, are you, Tony?
Not yeah.
He'd have to kill me if he told me. So, but so I think there's sort of three main areas I think we should talk about. I think we should talk about the coverage of conflicts, coverage of wars, which has obviously come into focus very recently in the conflict in Syria, which falls between war and civil unrest in a way, I suppose. It was funny when I, it was not funny, but when I did the, I wrote the flyer for this event, the number I got of number of journalists killed so far this year was 19. So I was thinking of rounding it up to 20, but I thought, you know, you're a journalist, you should stick to the figures. So I said Marie Colvin and the French journalist took it to 19. Since then, it's gone up to 22. There's been two journalists killed in Somalia and another freelance killed in Homs in Syria. So it just keeps going up and up. So this is an issue that's alive and today, and it's journalists out there under threat all the time. So we should talk about conflict reporting. I think we should also talk about civil unrest, I spoke to some war correspondents who said that one of the worst situations they'd ever been in was covering the red shirt protests in Bangkok, because there was no front lines and there was snipers and nobody knew who was shooting who. And also, thirdly, natural disasters. And the most striking one, of course, probably of all, was a year ago when we were in the middle of not only, the earthquake and the tsunami almost, everybody forgot about that. What really scared everybody covering it was the nuclear accident. So I think it would be good to start with the coverage of conflicts. And I'll just start with Tim. I mean, Tim, the numbers, the number of journalists being killed in conflicts is going up and up and up. Is the profession becoming more dangerous? In the old days, if you were killed on a Normandy beach by a German shell, it was bad luck. But nowadays, we get the feeling that journalists are increasingly being targeted. Do you think is that a fair comment?
In some ways, yes, but to mention the Second World War, that was incredibly dangerous for journalists. I mean, if you think about the amount of journalists that were killed in there, they were going in with the frontline troops just alongside them. And I've looked back over some of their coverage, which is amazing, and they were really, really at risk. So we haven't got to their levels, thank goodness. One of the things that...
But they weren't being deliberately targeted.
You're running in with the army that's invading you. I mean, everyone's a target on that. So, I think they were pretty much targets. These days, news has got so competitive, and the kind of the more individualistic, the more on your own journalist going into a conflict situation, which was we were aware of. In Indochina, in this kind of self-enterprising way of just following along on the troops, getting your own transport, jumping on the back of a truck, that kind of thing is much, much more rare nowadays, and for good reason. The reason that journalism is getting more dangerous is there's a huge demand for news. We have so many news outlets. We have 24-hour TV news. We have a host of online news. We have citizen journalists. We're used to getting our news now, right when it happens. We can't go somewhere and then file the story a week later, as used to be the case in the past. So there's an awful lot of pressure to get the story right now, and there's an awful lot of pressure to get a better story than the people next to you. And so that naturally puts you in a very difficult situation. As news organizations, large news organizations such as CNN and Reuters, we have a responsibility to protect the people that are working with us and not to place people under undue risk. And so, I mean, we do consider very carefully whenever we send our own crews into places, but if you're not in the places, you simply can't tell the story. I mean, Syria, of course, in the recent weeks is an example. Should we have gone into Syria, as various journalists did, CNN did go into Syria, our crew got in there and got out safely, thank goodness. It was a decision that CNN didn't take lightly. It had been Ara Damon, the reporter that went in there, and Neil Halsworthy. Ara had been trying to persuade CNN to go into Homs for a long time. That she had four different schemes of going in there. On the fourth different scheme, finally, management in connection with our security consultants decided that, you know, at this time, and given the situation as we see it now, we understand how you can get in there, spend the time, and get out, and so we decided to go for it. It was Tony Maddox, our head of news, it was a hard decision for him, he said, given Mary Colvin, maybe he'd have made a different decision if he was going to take that decision today. But it is a very dangerous situation now.
Phil?
I think you talk about it changing, yes. I mean, undoubtedly it has changed. Before I was in China, I was working in South Asia for Reuters for 4 years and looking after Sri Lanka at one end, Afghanistan at the other, Pakistan in the middle, and sometimes Bangladesh on the side, and a lot of trouble in India as well with the Naxals. I've seen it just recently. I'm still looking at security in South Asia and the Quran burning story. You know, we all of a sudden had a situation where we were trying to cover two mosque protests, one of which was going to be nastier than the other one. So we had to decide who to send to which story, the more experienced ones to the one that was going to get nasty, another one that was going to be less nasty we could send the less experienced guys to. And all the white guys and Europeans had to stay in the bureau because they were targets. They were all being targeted during that particular time. Anyone who wasn't a local was seen as a target because of the Quran burning. So it's kind of going up by degrees almost by every event that happens, it seems to me, especially in areas like Afghanistan, which seems to be getting more and more unstable and has done for the last couple of years. You have to balance as a manager whether you cover a story or not. Obviously, that's kind of our job. Do you go there? No story is worth getting killed for. So we have to kind of work out the risks involved, get them as low as possible. They can never be zero. You know, if they're zero, we'd never cover anything, right? You'd never cross the street. So you have to get to a point where, is the story worth it? Can you cover it safely? And can you get out? What are your exit routes? You know, and a lot of planning goes into this. You don't just go. You've got to work out where to stand, where your exit route is, make sure the driver doesn't run away. So you've got to have trusted drivers and fixers as well, because sometimes they do, they get scared and they just disappear. And then you're stuck without transport in a bad situation. And also really for news editors as well, it's not just the editor that's looking after safety, it's the news editor as well. So you say, right, we're covering two mosque protests stroke riots on the Quran burning. Do we want to cover the one in Jalalabad as well? You know, why do you want three versions of this story? You're getting two, that's probably enough. Let's lower the risk and let's tell the guys not to do the Jalalabad one. So it's a balance between news editing and risk. And sort of certainly part of my job, and I think yours as well, is mitigating that risk or getting the risk down as low as possible but still covering the story. When Eric mentioned the Fukushima, I've flown into lots of stories where the plane has been empty. It's quite cool. You sit on a plane with eight people on it. And the planes coming the other way are completely full. So we're always going one way, and everyone who's getting out sensibly is going the other. Same thing happened in Jakarta and various other things as well. So it's not about getting rid of risk completely. It's getting in, getting the story done as far as you can safely, and then getting out again and knowing how you get out. And for me, the thing that I always struggle with any story is, how much is the story worth? What risk is the story worth? And someone eventually, and Tim said it, you know, has to make that call. And sometimes it's a really hard call. And fortunately, the company I work for, I can overrule the editors. So I take the responsibility, but I can say, you're not covering this story. They freak out. But I say, well, sorry, you can't do that. So, you know, you have to have checks and balances. Because there's nothing worse than a gung-ho journalist in terms of safety. These are the guys that get into trouble. And I think we're going to talk about that later when we talk about freelancers and other people working in hostile regions.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Zero risk.
Nice little intro, thanks.
Yeah. That's the name of Tony's company. I mean, one thing I found was that sending war correspondents to conflicts, we had a, I mean, you do have this culture of the veteran war correspondent, and when we introduced us, as all the other major news organizations did, when we introduced hostile environment training courses, war training, whatever you want to call it, a lot of the old guys didn't want to do it. They thought that was for the youngsters. They'd been in, hey, I was in Vietnam, I was here, there, never, I've got nothing left to learn. And actually, when we insisted that they went, they either went to do the course or they didn't go on the job, and they came back and they learned things. So I'd like to ask you, Tony, in the time that you've been doing this, how do you think the situation has evolved, the risks have evolved for journalists? How do you see this? How do you compare the situation now with, say, 10 years ago or pre-Iraq or whatever?
It's massively changed, actually, Eric. And it's funny because I remember good old Richard Sambrook, my boss at the BBC, I was there for 14 years, gave me a check and asked me to run the first hostile environments course ever. And it was on the back of John Schofield coming back, unfortunately, when he was killed over there. And at that time, what they were dealing with really is just pure war zone stuff. It was just basically, you know, the war of convenience, as they called it, really. You could actually jump on a plane with a plane ticket and get into the area. And all of a sudden, there was a lot of people that were unaccounted for. They were flying around the different war zones, different fluid areas as well. And I thought at the end of the day that the BBC took the right stance in having a policy on this different training issues as well. But since then, natural disasters have just really rocketed. The actual world's become a different place. The Fukushima side of it, I actually believe strongly that a lot of the networks were ill-prepared in getting into these different areas. You know, we were talking about this just at the bar before about giving someone a Geiger counter. At the end of the day, there's the Geiger counter. Well, thank you very much for that, put that in the pocket. I haven't got a clue what to do with it, you know? So it's actually looking at the immediacies of natural disasters, and we covered the first one on Boxing Day, I'll never forget that, with the actual tsunami, where people were actually parachuting into this place to try and cover the story. Dealing with the terrorist groups, dealing with the actual natural disasters. Other subjects have emerged since then. Post-traumatic stress disorder is huge as far as journalists are concerned. We were talking about this today on the course with the team, and just looking at strategies with companies and how they can actually deal with various things. But the training side of it has actually got a lot better. We're not just dealing with the actual safety and security stuff now. We're dealing with it with IT security. Who'd have thought, you know, 10 years ago we'd be thinking about just exactly how you can be tracked, how you can actually be kind of found on Facebook because of various things that you're going to say or whatever. And I think that's the way that we're going at the moment now, is to actually make this a lot more of a safer place for journalists.
And, I mean, one thing Phil and Tim were saying is that obviously you don't want to get caught up in a bombing, but many journalists are killed and they don't pay attention to the little things. A lot of people die on holiday because they drive around in mopeds without helmets. I mean, what kind of situation do you see journalists arriving in a foreign country in a conflict or in a natural disaster? What's the kind of things they do that get them killed? I mean, road accidents is an obvious one. What's the sort of basic precautions you tell people to take?
The bottom line is that your life is in other people's hands in these different places, and you need a bloody good driver to actually be able to get you around to different places. Again, some of the course members were talking about this in certain situations in Libya, where you needed someone that can actually go, know exactly where he was going to, what he was doing, what was happening along the way. Somebody that can actually read the actual the situation on the ground as well, who's in charge of certain areas. What people don't know about, you can go into Libya, go into Afghanistan, and there are certain fiefdoms that control certain areas. So just when you thought you're actually playing sailing, going to a certain zone, somebody else has taken over and you're actually at their particular destiny. So it's pretty hard work.
So how do you see the, I mean, it's one thing for the foreign correspondent to fly in, but what's the responsibility towards the local journalists, the local drivers, the local people that die trying to evacuate you when you get wounded from the in a situation? Is it an ethical issue, or is it a practical issue, or do you just walk away? What's CNN's approach to the local people who are in the front line?
We're saying we can't work without local people. We're not from the place. We don't know the place well enough. It'd be very, very unsafe to work without local people, and would just be completely misinformed in any case. So we absolutely need local people. We have a decent network of people around the world. In most countries, there's someone that we can pick up the phone and call who can then start setting us up with fixes. But if we're coming to a situation cold, we have to build up our own network. We'll find one lead to find somebody in the area who can then try and sort us fixes, drivers, translators, and so on. But as I say, at the moment, we've got quite a good network, so we can usually find someone on the ground. But there's very different responsibilities towards the local people and ours. As we have, if we're caught, arrested on the ground in one of these places, generally speaking, something will happen. We may be held for a while, but we'll get out eventually. Our local staff, maybe not so much. In cases of kidnapping, there have been various cases of kidnapping where the foreign party has been eventually ransomed, but the local party has been killed. There are cases in totalitarian regimes where a fixer working for you, you'll be deported, but the fixer can spend years in prison. So it's a huge responsibility on us, and it causes a lot of difficult decisions that we have to make. If you go into Burma, for example, you want to find someone who can take you around who speaks Burmese. What do you tell them? Your storyline is that you're just to the authorities. Your storyline is that you're a regular tourist, just happens to be there. Is that what you tell your fixer? It's kind of irresponsible because they're putting themselves in line. But then when you tell them that you're media, then you're not allowing them deniability, and so there's various decisions. Though generally, in the Burmese example, when we're working in Burma, we did tell our fixers and translators that we are actually working for media, but they should tell the authorities that they didn't know that if they were picked up in any way.
Cool.
Yeah, I think honesty is the best policy. I don't think there's a real answer to this one. You can protect them from physical harm by using the same equipment as you do and going by the same sort of rules as you do. When you go into something like the riots that we had in Bangkok, the driver would stay away from the trouble because he needs to be ready to get you away, so he's not actually involved in the trouble itself. But that ethical issue of them being left behind as you fly out going, phew, we got away with that one. Even in China, we use local drivers in China and they drive us to areas, we get turned around. The police follow you 200 kilometers to make sure we're away from the area if they don't want us to go there. And we go back home. We generally keep in contact with the driver. Now, in somewhere like China, we keep in contact with them. And if there is any trouble, then I would go straight to the foreign ministry and try and sort it out. It's not to say I couldn't do anything. In a more extreme example, like the Syrias and Libyas and places like that, it's a really tough ethical dilemma. If you can use your own local drivers, which we do in Afghanistan, then it's different because we can protect them to some extent. But that is a tough one. I really don't know the answer. You can just try and lessen it as much as you possibly can. But honesty is probably the best policy, so they can just walk away if they don't like it.
You talked about, moving on, equipment. What do you recommend these days for journalists in either a situation like we had in Bangkok or in a war zone, but the actual physical equipment, the protective vest, the helmet, how has that evolved and what do you recommend? I know it depends on the situation, but
it very much does actually, Eric, and there's some interesting things. Even on the course this week in Chenchao, we looked at some of the cameraman's bags as well and just exactly how they're going to be moving around. I showed them one slide of a guy who was actually killed as a suspect suicide bomber, and he had on exactly the same kind of vest as you would do as a
Where was this?
This was in Iraq quite a few years ago. It was hate to say this, but it's the longest recorded kill. It's 2 kilometres out, so the sniper actually hit this guy as he was coming up towards the checkpoint. And what he had on was he had on a camera vest, style camera vest, with the pockets in the front. So what you've actually got is a misidentification straight away of an individual. But the kit itself, as we talked about, and certainly I've advocated over the years with the BBC and also with the company now, is go bags. Go bags are actually invaluable because you've got literally a couple of hours to sort yourself out before you're on that plane and getting out. And if you've got something that deals with civil disorder, you've got something that deals with natural disasters or whatever.
Go bags.
G-O. Yeah. G-O, yeah. The big...
ready to go.
Exactly. So basically your content's in there. You can grab your stuff. You can get out that door. And you know full well that you can survive. Because, again, the discussions that we had this week were incredible because we were talking about getting on the ground. I was actually in Gujarat many years ago covering the actual disaster there. We did a fantastic story as far as the BBC was concerned, but then all of a sudden we looked around and we went, where's the tents? Where's the sleeping bags? There was nothing. So from my point of view, really, is that the journalists themselves need to be a lot more savvy nowadays and think about what's going on, and the networks need to get right behind them as well to make sure that they have got that kit before they go.
Yeah, equipment like that, we had this with Fukushima. People were flying in from warmer parts of the world, and they thought, it's quite late in the year in Japan, it will be quite sunny, it was snowing, it was freezing roads. And they sort of got to Tokyo, didn't have any warm clothes, sort of running around the shops trying to get warm clothes and stuff like that. So it's, we get over that issue with sort of pre-trip briefings. So someone like me will call the correspondent and say, look at the temperature, grab your go bag, and make sure you've got all the right stuff. Paperwork too is important. You know, if you're going to a country that's a little bit sticky on things like who the hell are you, like China, have a few copies of your passport. You never hand your passport over, you give them a copy of it, to border guards and things like that. You would never hand your passport because in a lot of countries that just disappears. Things like identification. Do you want to carry your Reuters cards around? Do you actually want press accreditation cards on you? If you're trying to do something a little bit undercover in a region where there's not that much trouble, do you actually want to be identified? If you're working in Burma, you wouldn't carry your, Phil Smith correspondent, Reuters, if the police search your bags and things like that. So it's equipment, it's clothing, it's tents, and it's water, and it's food, and all those kind of things. But also don't forget things like identification. Do you need it? Do you want it? What form do you take? Do you hand your passport over? And all those kind of safety things. Usually with border guards, if they want your passport, wind the window down just a little bit, don't wind it right down, just push a photocopy through. And sometimes that's enough and they'll let you go. But if you push your passport through, then you're stuck if they don't give it back. All these things, it's not just one step, it's 3 or 4 steps you've got to think forward.
Also, talking about go bags, I mean, every bureau we have kit ready. There's tents, there's sleeping bags, there's water purification, there's places, things for storing water. There's kind of cooking MREs and things, have that around. But once you get down on the ground, also it's very important right away to start, if you're in a catastrophe, natural disaster, for example, is to try and set up some kind of supply route right away, because you're never going to have enough food to keep you going, you're never going to have enough water to keep you going, and you're never going to have enough gasoline to keep you going, and if you're working on generators and things. So it's not just having enough stuff to get you on the ground, you've got to immediately set up a whole logistical chain. Again, with the tsunami, the Indonesian or tsunami, and in Fukushima, there were different problems in the logistics of that. In the Indonesia, the Aceh tsunami, it was a long route driving through difficult roads with a possible terrorist threat along the road, and it took about 12 hours minimum to get the cars from one end to another. In Fukushima, we had a big problem with how do we drive up there, because we're driving through an area. Are we sure that area is safe because of the radiation coming out of the Fukushima power plant? I turned up in Fukushima very quickly, not in Fukushima, in Sendai, just near the where the tsunami happened, but north of Fukushima. I turned up there with an advanced crew straight on the plane from Hong Kong, changed planes in Japan, and a long drive up to Sendai. Got to the ground there, I found out obviously there's no power. There was no water to be had locally. There was no gasoline to be had locally. There were no hotels to be had locally. And I had 50 people arriving in 24 hours that I had to try and sort out stuff for. So these are really big problems.
Yeah, the hotels we got didn't have hot water either, which made the guys very unhappy.
Well, the hotel we eventually found, and about the hotel that wanted to close down, the Western wanted to close down and get everyone out there. But we were kind of standing in their lobby, and they weren't pulling their staff out yet. They let us use the rooms, but the rooms were as abandoned by the previous guests, so nothing had been changed in them. And for safety reasons, we were not allowed to lock the doors. And they only had one wing, so we were kind of squatting in the Western. But it was all right.
Did you pay the bill?
You know, I never followed that up. Originally, we said we'd pay the bill, but then they said, because we're not now functioning as a hotel and we are not offering you any hotel service, we are not going to charge you for this. So I think that in the end, they didn't charge us.
This was obviously not in Scotland. Anyway, so how what gear do you take to a nuclear accident?
A nuclear scientist. Basically...
Actually, the nuclear scientist is a very important thing.
Exactly.
Because one of the major problems we had was we do not understand on our first day on the job outside the nuclear power plant what is safe and what isn't safe. There's a huge amount of fear about nuclear contamination, as there should be. But it's even huger because it's a buzzword. It's something that's invisible. We don't really know. We can't see it happening. We don't know if we've been harmed by it. And we don't understand it. And we don't know what is harmful and what isn't. And nuclear radiation, like anything else, can damage you, like a toxin can damage you. It depends on the amount of exposure you get. And having someone be able to say right there, this level of exposure is okay and this level isn't, is very important. We had press reports very early on getting hysterical about levels of radiation being found on the west coast of the United States, levels being found on the east coast of the United States. I was saying in 48 hours, we're going to find the radiation coming back to us, having gone all the way around the world. Yes, you can detect that level of radiation, but it's so minute. It says more about how great we are at detecting things than how dangerous it is. But on the ground in Japan, it's very important to have someone who actually understood what radiation is. We flew someone from the States over to Japan just to oversee our radiation monitoring.
I think I've been involved in quite a lot of that stuff before. In the fallout of 9/11, we actually had the threat of the dirty bomb. And that raised a huge big kind of fear in everyone's kind of minds, is what's going to happen. And you're quite right, actually, Tim, on this one, is that it wasn't the gamma radiation that was going to be passing through people's bodies. It was alpha and beta particles that were going to be left on the ground. It doesn't take a nuclear scientist to work out at the end of the day just exactly what the contamination threats are going to be. You can actually do it quite simplistically. You know, you can get some decent suits that you can actually wear, respirators and so on and so forth. But the kit has to be fitted to the individual. They have to know exactly when to use it as well and when the actual threats are starting to come up. And I found that what we were doing is we were doing a lot of risk assessments on all this. And sounds like a paper trail or whatever, but it was fantastic as a memory jogger for the actual editors and the actual different people in the newsroom to understand exactly what they needed to do. And to get rid of this, the N dirty word, the nuclear, okay? It is a movable feast. We covered the Chernobyl disaster many years ago. And the biggest threat we ever had was the kit coming back in and contaminating the newsroom and different bases as well, because the actual tripods were covered in all kinds of different alpha and beta particles in the lithium threads, as we talked about today on the course. And it's about decontamination. It's not just about the actual, how are you going to cope with this? It's decontamination as well.
Yeah, it's bringing it back in. I think with the it brings up an interesting point about escape routes. I talked about escape routes later on, and one of the things that was in uppermost in our mind during Fukushima, when it went unstable, and there was lots of horror stories about total meltdown and another Chernobyl, and will the whole thing go off in a great big foom, that we immediately put in place an escape route from the north. So the guys in Sendai all had GPSs. They had a muster point. So they knew they could go straight there because they had a GPS. They could all drive there. We had enough gas. And then they would escape to the north and get out. So if anything bad happened, we had an escape route. And I think it underscores the importance of escape routes. If you get in trouble, you've got to know. If you get yourself into trouble, if you know how to get out, you can keep yourself very safe. But if you don't know which way to go, then you're screwed. You can't. You could go around in circles.
Can I give you, just a quick one? People have forgotten another disaster that happened about 8 years before Fukushima. That was Tokaimura, okay? And that was basically the reactor smashed through the roof and sent strontium and cesium as well spewing through the air. That was a nightmare because what happened was the networks themselves responded to the disaster, got to the front gates and started to report. I can think of about three journalists that were actually exposed to that and actually had some serious problems afterwards as well. So I can't underestimate the importance of actually planning with the whole thing with this.
Obviously, with the explosion of online media, citizens' journalism, as it were, there's a lot more freelancers, what you kind of people who just get on a plane and turn up. Are you coming across this in your experience that you're finding your experienced correspondents are finding themselves with basically amateur so-called citizens journalists or genuine well-intentioned freelancers who are putting with the modern technology they can go into zones they couldn't have got into before and are just totally ill-prepared for these situations? Do you think how much of a problem or an issue is this?
I think in terms of freelancers in war zones, yes, one of the reasons the casualty rate is going up is because a lot of guys are going in, just flying in with a camera, hoping to get that picture that will get them a job at CNN or Reuters or something like that. They have no training. They're very gung-ho, and they quite often get into trouble. You're talking more about using citizen journalism to cover stories, just like these guys do, just like we do. I think it depends. You can't stop people trying to get a story and then trying to get it back to you. In other words, taking to the streets, taking cloudy video through an iPhone of someone getting chopped up by the police or whatever it is. You're never going to be able to prevent that.
So we used a lot of that from Syria, obviously.
Yeah. I think if someone called me and said, I will go and do this, I would say, no, I don't want it. It's too risky. If I wouldn't send my guys in, I certainly wouldn't send a freelancer in. It's different in somewhere like Iran, where you can't get out on the streets and you've got someone in their apartment that's saying, well, I'm looking out the window and I can see this. Even then there's a problem because those people get picked off by the army. So even then they're at risk. But, you know, so again, it's an ethical question. But I would certainly never, and I think any of us would, ask a local to go, oh, yeah, can you go out and get a picture of that? You just wouldn't do it. But I think more frightening, and I think this happened in Egypt, where locals that had houses near the square were actually looking out, and the army were actually shooting at them because they didn't want the news getting out through the internet, because the internet was working the whole time. That's an interesting ethical dilemma.
But I think one thing about this citizen journalist, you see, they're not shot with high quality equipment by people who are professionals. They're shot largely on their cell phones. I mean, the people involved in these situations, in the current age that we are, with the internet and ways of getting your material out there, I think they're going to be shooting it anyway. They're not much of this video we're getting is not being shot because they want to sell it to Reuters or to CNN. They're shooting it because they wanted to get out. If they don't sell it to Reuters or CNN, they're going to upload it onto some video sharing site anyway. And so that's going to happen, whatever we do. In terms of whether we send someone into an area that's too dangerous for our own people, I mean, that is something that I hope we would not do.
How would you answer the ethical question of someone uploading something and then CNN running it globally? This person sees it and thinks, God, this is really coverage for my cause. I'm going to go out and get more.
I mean, that is a danger, yes.
I think I can see a flip side of this, though, is because we're working on two specific investigations at the moment. One is in the Sinai, looking at the organ harvesting. And the other one was mistaken identity of families that were killed in Afghanistan in the south by armed forces. And the video content that we've actually got through iPhones has been phenomenal, and it's actually helped us with our investigations along the way. So we can't rule out the fact that we can also use these particular images to help us out.
I'll throw this open to questions in a couple of minutes. I just wanted to ask slightly... I mean, this was something we talked about a lot during the war in Iraq, but the whole question of embeds. How do you think that's impacted the way the journalist is seen in these situations? On one hand, there's a sort of army argument that, well, if you're not embedded then, and if you're on the other side and you get a shell in the head, well, it's your fault because you should have been embedded with us. And the flip side of that is it also makes journalists look like they're part of the system. To the people on the other side.
To a large extent, you know, relying on embeds is an uncomfortable compromise that we have to do. I mean, we'd rather not have to do it. But in a lot of these situations, for example, in Afghanistan particularly, or in Iraq previously, just isn't practical for us to go to some of these more remote areas on our own. I mean, it would be putting too many people at risk to do it. There's an awful lot of compromises, a lot of downsides of just going on embeds that are very obvious to everyone, I'm sure.
Does it expose journalists to a greater risk of being accused of being spies, or?
Not a risk of accused of being spies, but accused of being cronies. Accused of just telling one side of the story, accused of taking sides is a big danger, accused of losing objectivity, accused of being subjective. I mean, when I say we have to rely on embeds, we still do cover the news in places like Afghanistan, not solely with embeds. We go and travel around to different places of the country, but there are areas that we would not go to because they're just simply unsecure without the level of security we have. On the other hand, going on an embed in cases, traveling with military, can put you at more risk in certain cases. If we're even traveling around Kabul, just from one area in Kabul to another, and we're in a military convoy, I feel much more worried than if I'm traveling in our beat-up old sedan with our local security there. Because in our beat-up old sedan, we blend into the traffic. No one's really going to target us. If we're in a three Humvee reinforced convoy, somebody with a car full of explosives who knows this route that convoys come past every now and then could ram into us and explode. If we're stopped in traffic in a military convoy, or even if I'm driving in a private car behind a military convoy, I feel very nervous in places like Kabul. So there's different sides of it.
And it's a cyclical thing. You know, 3 years ago in Kabul, you know, when I was there, I wouldn't have felt that uncomfortable because it was fairly peaceful. And it was like, but now things have ramped up a bit. You're going to be very uncomfortable being with the military. So again, you've got to look at what the background of the conflict is. It changes all the time. It goes up and down.
I think there's another, from a safety point of view as well, is that, talking about this in the last couple of months, we were talking about flat jackets and the use of flat jackets with embeds. Do you blend in? Okay. And in Afghanistan, there's been a change in policy in this because, as shocking as it seems, if you don't have the same as the embed and you're actually a white-vested, blue-vested or whatever, you're being targeted. And there's an incredible shift here because at the end of the day, no one's reporting, minimal amount of news agencies are reporting on the actual collateral damage that's being caused, but a journalist has been killed, my oh my, the news just goes rocketing through the roof. Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. On the story of embeds as well, is during the actual Gulf War I, Simpson himself, John Simpson, actually elected to not go with the embeds. He wanted to actually free range and go up to the north and whatever, to give a better unbiased view of the actual situation. And I think that's really, really important because I've seen it certainly within the Australian side of things where you can be controlled. You can be told you're going to A, to B, to C or whatever, and you're not going to see anything else at all. So it's really important you actually tell them the story from the other side as well.
Okay, thanks. So can I throw this open to questions? And Marty?
Testing.
During World War II, the journalists were often given military rank and issued with guns. And I think some in the Vietnam War also issued with guns. So tell me, what do you think about Bang Bang?
Funny, I had a conversation.
We're talking about that in the bar.
Yeah, I had a conversation with a Texan colleague of mine, and guess what he wanted to do? No, as a rule, I don't think we would carry. We certainly wouldn't. I don't think you would either.
CNN, we wouldn't carry guns, but honestly, our security guards in some cases, yeah, or in a lot of cases, would be armed if it's suitable, yeah, in that environment. But for actual CNN crews, no.
We would never do that either.
Tony, do you think that security people should always be armed or never armed? It's not that straightforward, is it?
No, it's not. I'd like to pick up on the point about the actual weapons side of it. Of course, we're trading AFP and all kinds of weapons this week. Basically, the bottom line is, and this is my own particular experience, is that if you have a journalist with a weapon, he becomes a combatant. Okay, you cannot give a journalist a weapon. There are many reasons why as well, and I'll give you four, again, that we were talking about. Number one is, as soon as you pick a weapon up and someone sees you from a distance, okay, you become a target. Number two is, you put a print on a weapon and it's been involved in a heist or something else like that, there's DNA there, there's a track back as well. And number three, the weapon itself actually could be contaminated. It could also be booby-trapped. I've seen many occasions where some of the situations I've been working in where the weapon has been hollowed out, and you pick the weapon up and you slide the working parts to the rear and it connects with the explosive and the stock explodes. Okay, so these are all very good reasons why you should never really touch a weapon at the end of the day. And I've advocated that on the course as well. Security consultants,
That of course goes if you come to a situation where there's been an incident happening and you see kind of bullets and things on the ground or ordnance on the ground or a weapon lying on the ground. It's very important not to go souvenir hunting and picking up things.
I will actually make a caveat on that particular statement there. In the case of Nazi Dalwazi, the journalist that was killed in Nablus quite a few years ago, what we're advocating with journalists as well is to make sure you can actually get casings or shells or whatever, something to give me, from an investigation point of view, a bit of a lead. Okay, but weapons, touching them, absolutely, do not do it.
How much of a problem is it for cameramen and photographers that you have something in your shoulder? I mean, can't a soldier yeah. tell the difference? Or
well, I mean, nowadays we're tending to use smaller cameras. There was a lot of There was a bit of opposition to that among a lot of cameramen because they like their camera with this great big chunk of glass on the front that's a brilliant lens that you can do an awful lot more with than the lightweight cameras. Basically, it's all due to the fact that you've got a great bit of glass on the front of your camera that can get lovely pictures. But it does make you very obvious, and so we tend to use smaller form cameras that are not. But the thing about a cameraman is you've got to be going out. You've got to actually see the incident. You've got to see it well, so you've got to try and get closer than you can. You've got to get the shot where you can. You're going to be hiding behind something and just trying to peer out on the edge. It's a tempting target for someone who's firing back in that direction. I mean, a journalist can kind of be a bit further back or doesn't need to get that perfect shot, but the cameraman really has to. And also, you know, that's your job. You want to get that most brilliant shot. So it's more obviously the camera crew is a very dangerous part.
Yeah, there's been a couple of cases of the large cameras, both on tripods and on the shoulder, where cameramen have just been shot because a soldier sees or a tank sees someone putting something like that with a big round thing on the front like that. Looks like an RPG, and they're just trained to shoot it. And there's been some pretty good documented evidence that was why these guys got shot. When there was one in Israel, it was a tank, and it was about 2 miles away on a ridge.
And that was the one I investigated.
They just saw this. And it
yeah, Tony, you...
I investigated
Tony,
that case.
You can tell us one or two cases.
Unbelievable. If you look at the footage and you look at the way the actual journalists were all lined up looking down towards Lebanon, what happened was Jeremy Bowen and the actual cameraman got out from the actual vehicle and were seen as potential kind of Hezbollah targets. They moved around, they got into position, they actually put their tripod legs down, and basically it was ITN who shot the footage. When I looked at it, the edit suite, it looked exactly like a mortar base plate position. So the tripod that you can see at the back there looked exactly like a mortar base plate position, and the Israelis actually thought it was a combatant kind of role and took aim and fired and actually killed Abed Takush, the driver, who'd been working for all the networks for 22 years.
Any other incidents?
The other one was an incredible one, actually, with Sky during the actual Bosnian conflict. Where in Bosnia, where what happened was the Bosnian Serbs had moved around to a position and were firing towards the actual the building, and one of the actual, the camera for Sky, spotted this guy firing an RPG. He'd fired the RPG, and of course it went into the Bosnian Serb area, moved around again, and the cameraman decided to take a position exactly the same place where the guy fired the RPG, and was shot in his arm here, dropped the camera to the floor, caused a lot of damage to the camera, but was lucky to survive with that because it obviously was ready for a bit of a headshot there. So in essence, what we're saying, you can be perceived as combatants. In John Schofield's case as well, when they walked into this position, they were all throwing their flat jackets on at the same time. So as they flew the flat jackets on at the same time, it looked like a military team in the area. And what happened was that Jonathan Burchill was actually pointing down at the range of the different areas and pointing to certain things because he was talking into his sound mic as well as a radio report, as he would do. And Jonathan Schofield was doing exactly the same. So when I actually chatted to the Croatian the military, they said, at that particular point, they looked like a military patrol, and that's why they took them out.
Okay. Another question? Tara?
The gender question. Tomorrow is International Women's Day. We're panelists all speaking today, men of experience in the field. There are more and more female senior journalists out there. Are we at greater risk? Are there some advantages to being a female journalist? And is it a different playing field for women out in the field?
Good.
I don't think it makes a lot of difference, frankly. I mean, the footage that I see from embeds, for example, in Afghanistan, I've got a piece of footage I'll show you tomorrow with Chizzy, our cameraman, and there's an Egyptian lady photographer with him. You can't tell she's a woman. She's got a helmet on, she's got a flak jacket, she's got everything. You can't actually, anyone looking through a telescopic sight wouldn't know she's a woman because she's got all the gear on, she's got a camera and everything. So it doesn't really show up in those kind of situations. I wouldn't have thought it makes a lot of difference. I think in terms, if I was with you and we had to run away from a riot in Seoul, you'd probably run faster than me. So you'd probably be safer than me, all right? Because you're probably more fit. But actually, I don't think it makes a difference. I mean, we have a lot of female embeds around, and you know, we had the Kabul bureau chief was a woman. It doesn't make a lot of difference. It can sometimes get politically difficult in somewhere like Pakistan, where the authorities won't deal with a lady bureau chief, and you know, sometimes that's difficult. Even that doesn't really make too much of a difference, really. So I personally don't think it makes a lot of difference.
Generally, no. In some cases, like in Pakistan and Afghanistan, if you're dealing on certain stories, it's actually better to have a woman, because for the whole male crew trying to do a story on women, it's just very, very hard in those countries. And of course, there are cases of a female correspondent, for example, or camera woman, but as you say, they're more kind of covered up. But a female correspondent in the street can attract a lot of unwanted attention, as happened in Egypt, of course, and happens in Afghanistan occasionally.
I actually...
Is there any particular advice to give to women war correspondents?
Go for it. That's all I'll say, because I'm actually working to Dateline, which is the SBS program, and 90% of the journalists in Dateline are 26-year-old females. And they are unbelievable. They get into some amazing places. They speak the language in certain places as well, and they got balls. But at the same time, they're really, really safe and savvy. They come on our training courses, and they actually knock the socks off some of the guys. Okay, I'm not saying it's a competition here, but at the end of the day, like, you know, they can get into some amazing places and get some great interviews. We had a fantastic interview with a female rape of Taliban, and we would never have got that interview had not been for our particular star reporter getting in there and actually doing the job and doing it very, very safely as well.
Thanks. And the quite interestingly, the International News Safety Institute, the INSEE, just published a book on women covering conflicts. And I mean, there was a woman, Lara Logan, who was covering the protests in Egypt, who was assaulted. So I mean, it's definitely it's an issue. Like, it's, you know, everybody faces their own risks. But I think this is the first time, I haven't actually seen this book, it's just been launched, I think, just this week, but it's the first time it's actually been actually addressed. So but I mean, I'm sure you've got the same experience, but many of the best war correspondents in the AFP's history have been women correspondents, starting with dear Kate Webb. Back, she was one of the very first women war correspondents in Vietnam in the 60s. So that's a long tradition. Next question. Any of our students want to ask anything? What's your name?
My name's Peter.
I should say everybody's supposed to identify themselves.
Sorry, my name is Peter. I'm a student at Hong Kong Baptist University, originally from Denmark. I would like to ask how to get started. I know it's a big question, but you talked about experienced journalist and unexperienced journalist. You would always choose the more experienced journalist and send him. How to get started as a young, educated journalist who wants to get out there? Because what does it take for you to send someone to a conflict zone?
I think time more than anything. You know, you can't just walk into a big news organization like CNN or Reuters or AP and just, they won't send you straight after a war. You know, you've got to be able to, you know, get the basics of writing and stuff like that. But you go to conflict zones in stages. you know, you go to small ones and then you go to bigger ones. You work in India for a while, you get used to incredibly bad road conditions and fixes that, you know, steal your money and the petrol and all the rest of it. And we tend to do it by degrees. So our guys who end up running Kabul do it step by step. Or we send them in with experienced journalists to do spells, you know, a couple of months reinforcement in somewhere in, you know, Islamabad or somewhere like that. But it's generally a build-up of experience. You won't find many big organizations that will take you and put you in. Occasionally, you find relatively inexperienced guys, like freelancers, and they will take themselves to Kabul. They'll operate for a couple of years. They'll do some good freelance work. Sometimes you can pick those guys up, send them off on a hostel, get them back to head office for a couple of months, train them up in your writing style and all the rest of it, then send them back. But generally, it's a case of joining a big organization and working up to this, rather than expecting to do it straight away.
Yeah, I really appreciate the thing about stages. Getting into an organization is important before you get sent somewhere. You're not necessarily going to be only covering wars. You know, you've got to put in your time. You've got to start somewhere else. You might be covering more local news. You might be covering political news or something. You're not necessarily going to go straight to a war. But if you can get into an organization and show that you've got the skills, if you're a shooter, you know how to shoot properly, you can edit properly, you can FTP and do all of the stuff. If you're a writer, you know how to tell a story, and you can show that you can actually shoot something, rather than just being your point of being to be in a particular place at a certain time. You've got to have a skill set beside you, and a proven one, in order to get sent somewhere. On the other hand, there is, if a freelancer goes to a place and gets some wonderful footage, that will get bored off them, and it may give them encouragement, and there may be a path in there. But if they haven't got the consistent skill set, then that's only going to get them so far. It'll get them to sell a few pieces of video, but if they can't operate as a network cameraman, then it's not going to get them very far in that career.
I mean, Tony, you've obviously trained a lot of journalists over the years in how to handle these situations. I mean, how would you? I mean, you must look at some people and think this guy's going to get himself killed if he's. You should maybe become the motoring correspondent or something. I mean, young or old or whatever, are there some basic values, basic common sense that's common to all people going into these situations?
I'd like to rewind it a little bit, actually, and take on the point that you made, really. Research is one, okay? Get your stories absolutely 100% right and try and sell it to the networks as well. I often see stories that are coming through and thrown at me from a point of view of safety and security. And you look at it, you go, there's no way that's going to get off the ground in a million years. Okay, so you're wasting your time in certain areas. But I do take on board what the gentleman was saying. Is basically, you need to actually start looking at your regional stories, look at your disasters or tsunamis or crime or whatever, and then build yourself up from there so you can get your experience. Training is really, really important. Whether you're doing domestic kind of safety courses or you're actually doing the international stuff that we do as well, is throwing yourself into that. And you're right, Eric. We actually do look at people and go, actually, we need to have a chat with you, because at the end of the day, you're not really cutting it as far as some of the actual scenarios are concerned. And it might not just be about the safety. It might be about your kind of leadership or direction or your kind of choice to take a particular decision or whatever. So we'll be able to actually hone in on that as well and make the mistakes before you get over to these bloody places as well. That's the most important thing.
Okay. Another question? Steve?
Again. Steve Coates from AFP. Hostage taking is a problem these days. Do you have an approach to this if one of your guys is or women is held hostage, taken hostage? What do you do?
Well, we were talking about this at the bar earlier, and it's something that no one is really going to talk about, because it depends which country you come from, it depends which country you're taken hostage in. And it depends on what policy your organization has got. Now, no organization is going to publish or tell anyone their policy, because once you've done that, you've blown it. So it very much depends. I mean, with Italians, I think, generally the government steps in with money, right? With Australians, they don't. I know a guy that was a hostage in Mogadishu for well over a year, and his family had to sell their house. I think the brother-in-law had to sell the house as well, and they got the money together. The company had a negotiator who was negotiating. The family was talking to this guy on and off when he was a hostage, and the money was handed over and he was released. So it depends on a lot of variables. But even if Tim knows what the CNN policy is, he's not going to tell you, because because you can't actually publicise what it is as a company.
But it is a huge risk, and so it's a big factor in, you know, where we'd send crews and correspondents and what conditions and how we send them, and having a place that we know that we feel is safe. So it's a huge factor in what we're planning to do.
But you're right, it is getting worse, and it worries the hell out of me.
What's your advice, Tony?
I got some interesting advice. I'd just like to pick up on the case of the Australian Paul Brennan. He suffered terribly in Mogadishu, and because the government didn't step in. They had this particular kind of mantra that they wouldn't do it. The bottom line is, Dick Smith, the entrepreneur, came in with quite a lot of money and dropped it into the hands of the actual negotiators to go and do the job. It's not about the hostage side of it. It's about the actual training in surveillance and counter-surveillance for journalists to actually make sure they can pick up on the signs of where things are going wrong. I was involved in negotiations for John Martinkus's release in Sada City quite a few years ago. I did a massive debrief with him. He knew he was about to be picked up, and he did nothing about it at the time, and he realized it was a mistake. The other thing as well is insurance. Get the right bloody insurance, okay? Read through the small print. Make sure that you have got adequate cover wherever you're going to.
John actually admits that he went to Mogadishu completely unprepared.
Paul Brennan.
And he said, you know, when they went out that day when they were taken, he said, looking back, it was so stupid because they didn't have the right training and they went to the wrong place at the wrong time.
If I may ask a question from a point of view of a print journalist, but one whose own experience would be that freelancers are actually able to become streetwise much more quickly and effectively than people who started off at, you know, in head office at Reuters or wherever, and that actually these are the people who don't need to be taught so much because they have already learned on the ground how to survive in difficult circumstances on their own without backup. Now I know this may not apply very effectively for people who need camera crews and so on, but at least as far as print journalists are concerned, that the best ones that I ever hired were always ones who started out as freelancers.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. You know, occasionally we come across these guys that are very good. They can write well because they've been selling stories to other people and they've been published and they've been able to live doing it. They've got streetwise on their own account, and yeah, we have employed these people in the past. You're absolutely right. That's not to say that we don't underscore that with our own style and our own methods of doing things and our own safety standards. If they're stepping over our mark and they're working for us, then they may have to stop doing certain things.
Yeah, once they come under on our payroll, then you know we're responsible for them, and so they have to come under what we do.
Sorry.
Yeah, just a quick pick up on that point. I think it's a really good point, actually. If I look at it from my point of view, when I joined Defence, there was a lot of kids in the room, 18, 19 years of age or whatever. And at the end of the day, you could tell the guys who had the hard knocks, the guys who'd actually walked the 9 yards as well in certain places. But it doesn't actually detract from the fact that they still needed the training on top of that as well. A mine, a booby trap, whatever, you never learn that on the streets. You learn that actually in the classroom. So that's really important to make.
Hi, this is Indranil from AFP. There are a few people in this room who covered the 2008 terror attacks. Like covered, I mean to say they were there. Phil, you were there in Mumbai at that time. So
the attacks in India.
Yeah, in India, in Mumbai, the Taj Oberoi and the Shabad House. Before that, there was we were not privy, or we were not experienced, or we did not face such an urban like attack, and it was like more like a case study because I was in Mumbai. A few gentlemen were in Mumbai. We had security agencies flying in. Like country after country after that to read the scenario, the whole, it was like a forensic evidence kind of thing. Has that attack made any difference in the shift in policy of the organizations towards how we should approach our work? Because Phil, you would know the distance between Taj and where we were is even like not even 500 meters with an AK-47. This is what I was talking with Tony like day before yesterday. And we had no space to go. Everybody was on that line, and we had, like, when the NSG came the next day morning, they had to literally kick us out of there, but we couldn't go. Like, we had to cover the news.
It was a lot of fun, wasn't it? that was interesting. I mean, the night I lived about 400 yards from Nariman House, and I heard some explosions, which I thought were festival fireworks still, and then I heard the automatic
India was playing England.
Yeah, the cricket match was going on. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so I left the house, much to my partner's horror, and I went and capped out, and I was running around. You know, the most frightening thing that happened to me that night was the dogs running after me, because I was running between the 3 points with about 15 wild dogs behind me. And I thought, any minute now, I'm going to get like this in my leg. But yeah, you were right. I mean, that wouldn't, you know, that was rare, because we were within, when I got to the Taj, there was no police, no army, no anything. I could have walked in. And that's when they were executing people on the staircase, right? And then grenades started coming out the windows, right, and stuff like that. It was before anyone arrived. And there was basically a curfew around the rest of the city. That's when the gunmen were walking down from the thing.
From Leopold to from
the station, right?
Yeah.
My big problem on that night as the editor at the time was I was the only one that was hostile trained. Well, there was two of us in the bureau that had hostiles, because it was basically a financial bureau, right? Why do you want to train the stock market reporters up? If you ask me what the difference now is, now we've trained a lot of the ordinary guys, so they can at least go to the hospitals and count the bodies and do all those kind of ancillary tasks that you have with a story like that. While the guys with the flak jackets, which I had some at home, and I had my driver, so I had all the gear ready to go. You know, extra mobile phone batteries and all that kind of preparation that you had, we had ready. But I couldn't deploy enough people on the street because they weren't trained properly. So the lesson I learned from that is that in a city like that, where potentially you've got things like that happening, you need a few other guys trained up, even if they're not going to use it on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Mumbai as well. I got there a few days later. And even then, I mean, most of the shooting had died down. There were still the occasional shots coming from the Taj. I was on the line of cameras, just, you know, far too close, really, if anything was going on there.
Yes.
One thing that was I found rather disturbing about people's coverage, ours included at that time, was while the hostages were in the hotel, people were on the air doing phone reports from the hotel on our air. Now, we know that the hostage takers were in contact with people in Pakistan who are watching the media, and this is so we're actually giving the hostage takers information. Oh, there's a few left up there, we can go and get a few more, which is very dangerous, and I think in retrospect that was a bit irresponsible. Same thing happened. So part of the thing about how we cover the news is, now that the people on the other side are actually seeing how we're covering the news, that can be a big concern, especially in the Philippines bus incident a year ago as well. I mean, media played a large role in the unhappy outcome of possibly in the unhappy outcome of that. So but that's another thing that we have to bear in mind.
Yeah, there was a huge inquest on that point, because the Indian TV went absolutely nuts. And they were doing stuff live from the rooms and things like that, and all the TVs were still on in the hotel. I think they got shut off fairly early, I think later in the session, but it was very true.
The hostage takers were in close contact with Pakistan, where they could see
them. It was giving intelligence to the hostage takers.
Obviously my role is the safety and security side of it. Two interesting things with the Mumbai attack. Number one is that we started to use the mobile phone a lot more. There was one gentleman who was actually working for a news network who had actually landed there that day as the financial controller and thought there was fireworks outside and hadn't got a clue what was going on. He was actually in the Oberoi Hotel. We actually used the Google Maps to get him out from there, to move him all the way around the back of the hotel and down towards the actual safety side of it. So it's a great little success story where you're actually using local technology, or increased technology, I should say. And the second point I want to make is we actually started to look at the Mumbai attack and thought, hang on a sec, we're missing a trick here. We're actually sending people on hostile environments courses, and they're coming here every now and again to have a look at the course. But what we've now produced is the hostile environments course on the mobile, so you can actually flick your mobile on in an Oberoi attack or whatever, or a Mumbai attack, and you can look at what to do, because we've got these little video interstitials to show people exactly what to do, to give them some tips anyway if there's a hotel fire or something like that. So it's a fantastic way. It's a new jump in safety and security, really, to put it onto the mobile.
Question?
Yeah, thanks. I will have a question to...
What's your name?
My name is Stephanie. Yeah. thank you. My question is about the journalist career. Now, we know there are most important international news breaking out in the world, so most of the media in China would love to broadcast the international news. So my question is very, very easy. Now, I know the four of the professors are very, very professional. If any Do you want to do the analysis or give comment to on this international news on the TV? If you somebody invite you to analyze international news on talking about the era crisis and give a comment, do you would love to share your experience and give you ideas about this politics news?
Do you mean would I do that on Chinese TV?
Yes, correct.
Yes, I would. Yes.
Yes, you do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. CCTV 9. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. There's no. You know, in China, there is, for us, there is no censorship. You know, we file direct to line, I say what I want, and then I'm held accountable by the foreign ministry or the SCIO. So, yes, absolutely, you would.
That's an analyze the situation.
Sorry?
Analyze and give comments.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. If CCTV 9 asked me on and say...
Except CCTV, well, not just only CCTV.
Yeah, or Xinhua, the whole lot. Yeah, I mean, if you get invited, you have to be invited on, obviously.
Okay.
Otherwise, you can't comment. But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. This is my question. Yeah.
I've been interviewed in Chinese TV too, and I mean, it's been interviewed anywhere.
Which just goes to prove how desperate they are.
I mean, the advantage is they didn't understand my accent. You know.
Yes.
But I just wanted to make a point. It doesn't really matter if it's China or anywhere else. They will take out of what you say what they want. It can be China or it can be CNN or Al Jazeera. It doesn't matter, or AFP TV. I mean, they will interview you and then whatever story they want to take out of it, they'll do it, you know. So, so you can interview us after the session?
Yes.
Next question. Any one of the students, come on.
Hi, my name is Jasmine, and I'm also from Hong Kong Baptist University. And I have a question on the balancing point, because everyone has different perspective. For example, a very experienced journalist has been working for so many years on a correspondent, and he really wants to like finding the truth and has the passion to go into some very dangerous place. So what is his balancing point? Because everyone is different, yeah.
It's not his balancing point, it's the editor's balancing point. You know, where people like Tim and I are responsible for the journalist's safety. So as long as he's working for us, we say it's safe to go there. And like I said earlier, the worst thing for us is a gung-ho journalist that will disappear.
On the other hand, if there's a crew of journalists, like in TV, it's rarely one person going everywhere, even though sometimes some of our management would love it if one person did everything. But often it's a crew of people. And then, I mean, in any situation, any member of the crew has got the right to say, I'm not going to do this, I'm not up for this. Yeah. So anyone in the crew can pull out. It's and if you're going to say, if there's a group of people going to one area, if one person says, this isn't good, I don't want to go, then the general accepted practice would be that, you know, everyone would stop.
Yeah, it's a very important point that we hammer home to people. If they feel uncomfortable in a situation, then they don't go. And there is no repercussion to their career or anything like that. We had one example in Fukushima where one of the guys said, my wife is freaking out, I can't see this radiation, she wants me to go home, so we flew him home. And there's no question.
We had cases like that at CNN as well. There's absolutely no question.
I just wanted to ask you, CNN and Reuters, what's your policy on the material you receive on social media, social networks? We had it from Iran, we have it from Syria. What point do you say, you know, this really is biased, this is, you know, I mean, how do you make an editorial judgment on what you give? Do you just give everything, or you obviously don't give everything? Where do you draw the line? I mean, this is these are people who are probably activists one side or the other, so they're not impartial, and they're sending us this stuff because they want to prove a point. Do you just give it? How do you make the editorial judgment?
You probably use more than...
Yeah, I mean, and also I'm not involved myself personally in the editorial judgment of which clips we use and which we don't, but obviously there's a few things. One is, do we know what... have we got a good idea that this is what it says it is? if we just see people, there was a famous case of a still photograph of a kidnapped US soldier that turned out to be a GIO doll a few years ago, for example. You could easily end up making a huge and embarrassing mistake. So do we have a good idea that this is what it says it is? Then we have to attribute it. This is what we are told this is. And so that we cannot independently verify this is what it says it is. So we have to add disclaimers on it. Is it fit to be aired? I mean, some stuff is just too horrible for us to air on TV. And also, is it blatantly giving a message? I mean, we're not going to show someone necessarily ranting and telling us the message. Though we do. I mean, we get videos from the Taliban where they're coming up there and saying their message, and we'll run that on the news merit of what it is, and we'll qualify it in whichever ways we have to do.
There are ways with video and pictures as well. You can blow them up. You can look at tax disc on cars to make sure it's, you know, the date.
We vet them. We vet them. We have people whose job is just vetting the reports that we come in.
Douglas Wong. I work for Bloomberg. I'm interested to know what your news organizations, what your perception of how, as we say, no story is worth dying for. News organizations become a lot more conscious of the responsibility to their staff, to the freelancers, other people they work with. So we're spending more on training, the cost of it. Have you seen in the last few years, as that trend has developed and journalists are more in the firing line, news organizations deciding more and more not to cover things because of the security issue? And where do you see those trends going?
From our point of view, I think it's true. I mean, for Reuters, it happened in Somalia years back when two guys died and then we just pulled everyone off the ground. And the only way we covered it after that was in army helicopters from the air. So yes, it does pull people off the ground. If it gets too dangerous, you pull people out. So there will be, that can probably, in some areas of the world, only get worse. How you deal with it on an ongoing basis, I think you do it on a case-by-case basis. But yes, it will probably get worse. Maybe everything will go away tomorrow, I don't know. But there will always be trouble spots. But if it gets somewhere like Somalia where it gets really kind of nasty, you just pull people out. You can't leave people in. Mogadishu is a good example. Now, we have local stringers in Mogadishu, but we would never send a Westerner in there. It's just too dangerous. But we get stories. We get Dateline Mogadishu because we've got guys, local guys, that are working for us there. So you can cover it on the ground through locals. You sometimes have an ethical issue about them getting into trouble. The tribal areas of Pakistan, for example, in the north, you know, we supply cameras to people and stuff like that. One little story, when I was looking after Pakistan, one of the stringers we had in the tribal areas in northern Pakistan arrived in the bureau with a gun on his lap and a bullet wound in his elbow and said, "You've got to protect me and my family. I've been shot because the Taliban are after me because they know I'm working for you." And eventually, after about a year, we worked out he was actually shot by his neighbor over a land dispute. So it's kind of difficult. So, you know, operating in those kind of areas is hard. Where you can't, I can't go there. It's impossible for me, you know. And in Kabul just recently we've had, you know, where foreigners are being targeted because of the Quran burning. You can't leave the building. So, yeah, I think it can probably only get worse.
I think pulling
people out.
Just on, I think it's a really good question, actually, because I'm working across different agencies, all of a sudden someone says to me, "We'd like to go into Mogadishu." And the answer is, from everybody, no, it's too dangerous, some of you. But all of a sudden, someone's actually coming back with all kinds of different safety parameters, controls, and whatever, and then the actual security companies are great. Other organizations then potentially could lose out, because at the end of the day, they've actually... And the trick of this, really, is these guys here having their eye completely across all the different stories that are going on and making sure that they're looking for the opportunity to get in there. Otherwise, it's missed completely. And that part of the world is not really reported on. But the locals are really, really important to this particular stage, and also is a very, very good security company within that country that people need to explore. And the story that we've just worked on in Mogadishu, we took civilians in there. We didn't take journalists or whatever, and everyone's going to be shock, horror, or whatever. But we got them in there for a very good reason, because we wanted to do a story about refugees returning to a place. And we did it safely, and we were proud to do that as well.
I'm not sure that we're covering an awful lot less. I think we're covering it maybe in a slightly more planned and with more backup way than we did before. But we were never ones to send people into a situation that we thought was, you know, too dangerous for them to go in. There are lots of cases in the past where we could go into areas we didn't used to. Many years ago, when I first joined CNN, back shortly after the Second World War, we didn't have security going along with us. You know, we'd travel in southern Philippines just with local fixers, or we'd travel in tribal areas of Pakistan by dressing up in local clothing and going in there. And we could do it at that time. We just can't do it that way anymore because the risks have got more.
Another question? We've got about 5 minutes.
I want to ask, there are some organizations, I'm Sophia from Hong Kong U.
Yes.
I want to ask, there are organizations formed to defend journalists worldwide, such as the CPG, the Committee to Protect Journalists. Do you think they are effective? Thank you.
There's more and more. There's the
NCA. There's more and more. They're springing up. I mean, anything that sort of looks at safety and tries to keep people safe can only be a good thing. I mean, what are your contacts with these guys? You're pulling a face.
Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I like the statement that you said. There's more and more of these organisations cropping up and wherever you. I think that some organisations do a very, very good job at looking after journalists, but I feel that some of them are out of touch with what happens on in the field, because we work in the field on a regular basis. And I think that they need to be re-educated, really, in what the essence is of journalism, but not just that, but also the survival and safety skills. And I'm all for an organization putting their money on the line and actually making sure that you've got this. I mean, last year, I got no response at all from some of the organizations when I actually offered a free freelance course in hostile environments training. Nothing at all. And I was quite shocked, actually. So my view on this is kind of skewed at the moment.
I think I was asked by an organization not long ago, if we have one course from a hostile training course company like Zero Risk, then we can do our own. No, you can't. Sorry, you can't do that. You can't. It's not like teaching, taking a typing course and then you can teach people to type. You can't do that. It's a very dynamic science. You need these guys, come back with us with new gear, different equipment. They're looking at situations all around the world that we don't look at that closely, and as they change and things like that. So some organizations think they can do hostile training themselves, and that's absolutely not right.
And just picking up on that point, it's a really good point. We're flipping over to the hostile environments training providers. There's a lot of really good military people out there with very little journalist experience. So what you're going to get is a very didactic course that actually tells you what's going to happen from A to B. But what we need to know is actually what happens in the meantime, how we're going to make decisions on getting the story. They miss the point that first and foremost, you're there to get the story. Okay, and that kind of gets diluted in some of the hostile environments training as well.
Yeah, which is why we tend to work with the same company for a long time, and I'm sure CNN
does.
And you tailor the course around what you're trying to do, whether it's taking pictures, footage, writing stories, the size of the teams going in, and the size of the company and the sort of stories you want to do. So it's not just an off-the-shelf training course, like you say. Otherwise, it tends to get very tight and small, and it's all about bombs and bullets when we're talking about riots and earthquakes and tsunamis and all the rest.
We work with the same security contractor who do our hostile environments training and who also provide personnel for us when we work in the field with them. And so we've worked with them for many years, so they actually do understand the journalist side. But they use freelancers themselves sometimes, and it's not necessarily everyone working for them has worked for years. So even with people that you're working with from the same company, you have different results. I mean, some get it much more about how you've got to do your job, and others will kind of be more concerned about following the procedures by the book and not letting you enough time to get the shots that you need. So there's a bit of tension sometimes on that. But generally, by working with the same company that have worked with us for many years, we get on quite well.
Probably have time for one last question. Yes.
I'm not a journalist. I'm Joel Lakin, PR guy. But we're involved with the power business. So we find ourselves in strange places like Pakistan. I don't go to Pakistan unless I absolutely know there's going to be lots of security all the time. Now, question. I remember the big flap after 9/11. The suggestion was, let's arm the airline pilots. And of course, the Airline Pilots Association said, no, we don't want to carry guns. And I'm quite sure most of you guys don't want to carry guns, but some might want to carry a gun. And when you say training, would that possibly include weapons training, or is that too far-fetched? You're shaking your head. Then you refer to security. That's an extra expense. It's already pretty expensive to send you guys out with all your equipment and all that. But is there a policy when you're going to Tijuana, Mexico, and or downtown LA, or someplace that's kind of dangerous right now, don't you have policies for standby security? Any of you? No?
When you talk about standby security, what do you mean? I mean, we've got general safety in places like hotels where you use alarm wedges under the door and those kind of things. In downtown LA? Yeah.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, in the riots in London a few years ago, we had some security people on the streets of London with our guys, not armed, and we weren't wearing flak jackets, but they were there just to kind of pull someone free if they got, you know, a crowd came around because they were being quite nasty towards journalists. So we felt that it'd be better if we had a security guy there who, if some incident was happening, could get our people out of there. If there's a stabbing or a banging on the head or something, they could do first aid. I mean, the same, I'm sure, as if we're going down to Tijuana and dealing with drug cartels, the same thing would be happening in that situation.
But they would shoot you. But yeah, bodyguards, yes, if they're necessary, but it's kind of not Hollywood really most of the time.
Can I, sorry, just to make a comment on that, I like the reference to the airlines, by the way. I love that. We train airline companies, and we've got a very good defensive tactics policy, and also the airline pilots are offensive tactically trained. Okay, so that's one particular point. The Tijuana situation, I completely agree with our learned gentleman here, is that basically you're looking for someone to blend in, to be with somebody, to make sure they've actually got the right kind of protection. The guy that looks like this, or the cauliflower ear brigade, doesn't cut it.
Okay, I'll allow myself one last question before we wrap it up. And we had a correspondent in Afghanistan a few years back who actually, I think he was actually once seen firing RPGs. And he was quite proud. He said that his death tolls, this always gets an interesting story, is always quite good for people that don't know, never met a war correspondent. He once proudly told me his death tolls were always accurate. I had a feeling what was coming, but I asked him anyway. I said, how? And he said, because they come in, they count arms and legs. I always count the heads. You count the heads, you never get your death toll wrong. And when he finally left us, I said, sorry? I said, what are you going to do next? He said, I'm looking for another war, you know? So, you cannot pay a big enough tribute to somebody like Mary Colvin, who lost an eye in Sri Lanka. She was in Tahrir Square. She died in Homs. What is it? I mean, people come up and say, you know, isn't this a bit weird? Why would somebody do this? I mean, why does somebody cover the Afghan war and count heads? Why do people go from war to war to war? Is it the desire? Because you have to tell the story. There's only one worse thing than covering a war is not covering it. Or does it become something else? Does it become something else? And people ask me this all the time. Why do they do this? Is it purely journalistic, tell the story, or is it something else?
I mean, it's not just to pay the mortgage. No. That's the truth, because there's many other ways to pay the mortgage. There's journalism as a whole, for me, was always about being near to somewhere where history was happening. It's the nearest I could get to be where history is happening. But that doesn't really explain going to places where it's dangerous, because there's lots of history that isn't dangerous. There is a certain amount of excitement to it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's different people. I mean, some people are quite happy to be a White House photographer and travel on Air Force One, and it's the best chat-up line in the world, and they're quite happy to do that, and they never want to go to a war zone. But it is the excitement. I mean, I said the Bombay sieges were a lot of fun. I had tremendous fun. My boss was getting calls at the time from like the business side and other people saying, oh, it's Phil O'Riot. And he said, I didn't have the heart to tell him you're having the best fun you've had for years. And it was great. And it was, you know, I was remembering all the things and I was trying to keep safe, but I did have tremendous fun. It was a huge rush to cover that. And yeah, it was fun and it was exciting.
What's your take on people who want to cover wars, Tony? Apart from giving you good business.
I think I come across quite a lot of an eclectic mix of people, really, that come on the courses and they're just about to actually ferry themselves off to the far-flung places. But there's some incredible people, really, that actually live in some of these areas that want to bring the story back. They feel that the country itself is letting itself down, that they're not actually telling the story. And I've got every admiration for that particular person, because they are the ones that are putting themselves in the line of fire. They're actually the ones, the locals, that are going back where they could actually be lynched or whatever. And I feel there's a general passion there. And you look at it from the eyes of the journalists when they're coming on training courses, and it is amazing. You know, they can see they're actually going, oh my God, this happens, and so on and so forth, as that happens. We're trying to paint a picture of safety, but at the same time, we are painting a bit of a grim picture, but they still go time and time again.
I think Phil put it quite well that, I mean, for the student journalists here, if you ever find yourself in an empty plane, you're welcome to the club, you know. So anyway, that was very interesting. Thanks very much, Phil and Tim, Tony, for your. Flak jackets. Okay, thank you. I think there's some. I think there's some munchies as well. So thank you. And thanks very much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.